that the rate of return on private capital of any kind, including government bonds, is zero. Because under the current system, no money is ever saved or invested for any individual in any way. All of the taxes that you pay for your retirement, none of that is in saved or invested. So any rate of return should be compared to that zero investment that takes place in the current system. And lastly, I agree that you can't make it come back. There's no way you can make up for bad policy in the past. We've spent the money, that's gone. But you can stop spending in the future. If you have a credit card and you've run up a huge debt, you can't get out of paying it. But you don't go down and start charging again tonight. And the problem with Social Security is that every day it continues, it runs up additional unfunded liability, an additional debt. So if we move to a privatized system, we've got to pay off the past. But at least from that point on, we're not accumulating additional unfunded liabilities that we are every day under the current system.
Okay, Alan, I see you're shaking your head.
Well, I just think that's wrong. I mean, the first point about the size, the magnitude of the deficit, I think it's just a question of whether you're talking about Social Security or the overall government. It's true that the Social Security surplus is currently, or the trust fund is held in government debt, which means that as a whole, it doesn't help. It's not really there, and so there is a bigger gap, but that gap resides elsewhere in the government. And indeed, President Clinton's proposal to put more national debt into the Social Security Trust Fund would simply increase that to the benefit of the Social Security system and to the detriment of the rest of the government. So the gap is bigger if you look at the whole government, but it still, I think, is useful to think about where the gap is in the government. Okay, so I don't know that we have a big disagreement there. In terms of the zero rate of return, the reason why the rate of return is zero is because, or whatever, in a more general case, however quickly the economy is growing, is because it's a pay-as-you-go system. If it were a funded system, you could have a funded federal system. We don't have one, but you could have a funded federal system, and if it were funded, the money would be invested in government bonds or something else, and it would be earning some rate of return. But the point is, you can't go from an unfunded system to a funded system by going to a private system. You've still got the overhang of existing liabilities, and that has to be resolved.
Preston, you have any comments? Okay, so we'll open up questions, and Ray has a mic if you'd use that. And
I know the current surpluses that we're running are really not surpluses, they're counting the Social Security surplus, but the projections we've seen recently are that we will have a real surplus in starting in 2002 or something like that. Can we use that to do what you're talking about, get us through this transition period? I agree the problem between, you know, how are we, the current people have to pay twice. They have to pay for their own retirement, and they have to pay the people who are currently retired. Could we, in your view, could we use these projected surpluses to do that?
Who are you asking the question?
Anybody who wants to answer.
Let me just answer a piece of it. In terms of numbers, there's not enough there. So if you took that amount and you said we're going to take all of that money and as we buy back that national debt, we'll put it into the Social Security Trust Fund, it's way too small, even if it comes to be.
I agree with that. The only point is that there for the current system as well. It's not enough to prop up the current system as well. There's no way around the past debt. Whether you keep the current system or you go to a privatized system, you've got that cost. But because the privatized system stopped accumulating debt, the long run, it will always be cheaper. No matter what mechanism you choose to fund the transition, whether you raise taxes, whether you cut other government spending, which is what I recommend, whether you issue debt, it is always less to stop now and then move to simply transition to the privatized system than it is to prop up the current system indefinitely into the future.
I have a question concerning, you guys are doing a wonderful job of popularizing the problem, but in terms of coming up with a solution, it seems like it's coming upon us pretty quickly. And what do you guys make of pure voluntary ideas such as tax sheltered annuities. If you're worried about risk, you could buy a whole life insurance policy. If you're not worried about it, you can get into mutual funds, 401ks, that kind of thing. What do you think about educating people and not forcing them to do anything that they don't want to do with their money, but also showing them the benefits of planning for the future?
Well, I'm all in favor of any savings vehicles in any way we can convince people to save. The problem is the people who can afford to do it generally are. A lot of people can't afford to do it. That minimum wage worker, after he's done paying his food and his rent and clothing and his medical bills, doesn't have a whole lot of discretionary income in which to save, especially since he's being forced to put 12.4% of his income into the Social Security system. If we're going to find a way for him to save, we've got to find a way to give him back some of that 12.4%, or he's simply not going to be able to participate in any way in the system. And that's actually, if there was no other reason to privatize Social Security, that's why I would do it. Because right now we have a problem in this country with a growing wealth disparity. One top 1% of incomes owns more than half of all the wealth in this country. If you want to look at, for example, the difference between blacks and whites, the black-white wage gap is shrinking, continuing to shrink, which is a good thing. The wealth gap between black families and white families is growing. And the reason is that blacks have not been able to participate, by and large, in the savings boom that's been going on, and the growth of equities, and in the bull market. We need to find a way in which we can take people of middle and lower income and allow them to participate in real wealth accumulation, which is what privatization would do.
Good. I think your question is well posed. But I urge each of you again to participate in the pressure to begin Social Security reform, to take the very first steps, however minor. Let me remind you of another situation of the last decade or so. Many, many of us have been working in the so-called financial institution reform process, you know, attempting to widen the purview of the services that financial institutions can offer. And it's been 10 years, and we've made a little progress, but you don't give up in political matters in the political world. You know, you do an increment something this year, you do an increment the next year. It's going to be a big issue in the presidential campaign. Okay, fine, let's get some steps toward reform over time.
How about right up here?
This is, actually, I refer back to something Mr. Tanner said about the fact that we're entering the 21st century with a 19th century vehicle. I'm just wondering, and I'd like to have the panel's reaction to this. No one mentioned means testing. And the way I see the world, people have changed very much. The generation that's receiving the Social Security benefits lived through the Depression has a completely different take on what risks are, on how, where they're going, or if they're not going anywhere anymore. But many of those people have retired on really very good retirement plans and are, you know, extremely well off. And they are being supported by the person who is spending 12% of his wages, holding three jobs and not having any hope at all in life. Now, the people who are now young people, and just recently I read an article about how jobs have changed. You alluded to that, but a number of people are now private, you know, are self-employed. They pay twice as much. That is, they pay the full 12% themselves. They don't have an employer. So the way the world of work has changed. And I'm just wondering whether it would be possible to say, okay, we stop right now. If you're 40 years old, whatever the arbitrary number is, this is a transfer thing. It's not, this is a transfer payment. This is a way of moving money from people who have it to people who don't. But from now on, everybody else can invest in the private sector. and build up a nest egg, and then it is something that's transferable from one generation to the next. So when a woman dies at the age of 56 and has two children who are in their 20s and she's worked all her life, something remains of that that her children can have.
I think that is what we should do. The only caution I would offer on means testing is there's just not enough money there. I hear this a lot. Ross Perot brought it up. It was great. And Ross Perot would say, why should I get a Social Security check? Well, I don't know why you should, but there's not enough Ross Perots out there to save Social Security. The fact is, if you really wanted to finance the future Social Security benefits through means testing, you have to start means testing at around $30,000 a year, which is something that politically would never fly.
Okay,
yes. Aren't there really three issues that need to be addressed in order to get at reform? And that is that you need to address government spending, you need to address the debt, and Social Security, and that they're all intertwined and one can't be dealt with without dealing with the other?
No, I don't agree with that. I mean, there are problems. First of all, the debt. I think we focus too much on the current level of the national debt. Most of the problems we have now, as we heard, is the wolf at the door, and it's because we know that we're going into debt in the future. And so focusing on the current level of the national debt, as a lot of the current discussion tends to do, I think is probably not that productive, because congratulating ourselves on the level of the national debt doesn't really get us very far in solving these problems. We've got a lot of different problems. We got a problem with the two big problems right now are Medicare and Social Security. That's where the long-run problems come from. And Medicare is about three times as big as Social Security. And if you take Medicare and Social Security away, we don't have a problem. We don't have a problem with the debt. We don't have a problem with an imbalance between taxes and spending. Spending, aside from Social Security and Medicare, as a share of GDP is much lower now than it was 10 years ago. So there's not a general problem. Those two very big and very specific problems.
On the side, we have a question.
One question addressed to Professor Auerbach. You mentioned in your talk, but didn't give any specifics, that there are better and worse ways of approaching these problems, and I'd be interested in what you think are some of the better and worse ways. And then a second question for anyone on the panel is, if there were to be some, and there would presumably have to be some sort of transition to any sort of changed regime, how would you envision that happening, both, you know, over some period of time, over various demographic groups, over various income groups, sort of any ideas along those lines?
I'll give you some examples, although I think if you wanted to get some bad ideas, being closer to Washington would probably help. Good idea. I think indexing retirement age, for example. We've had a retirement age of 65. We're slowly moving up to 67, but we've had a retirement age of 65 since the 1930s, when life expectancy was much, much lower than it is right now, and much lower still.
Invented by von Bismarck.
Right. Yeah. When it was originally conceived, it was a plan that virtually nobody would live to see. So indexing the retirement age is certainly one thing that's an obvious thing to do. Bad ideas. I don't think uncapping the payroll tax is a good idea. And again, I think that's in a sense making the system larger, bringing more money into the system, and involves also making more commitments. So anything that would expand the system in the long run by bringing in more workers or bringing in more wages, I think, is a bad idea. So those are just two examples.
I'll answer your second question. I just want to comment on the retirement age real quick. This is one that you talk about disconnect to society. You had all the economists and actuaries and policy walks in Washington in a room, 99% of them would say raise the retirement age, including myself. Take it out to the public and it doesn't fly at all. And there are a lot of problems with it. It's one thing for those of us who are going to be teaching and shuffling papers into our 90s. It's another thing for a coal miner and a longshoreman out there. Now, what do you do? The life expectancy of black men today is 65 years and 6 months. And if you raise the retirement age too much, then none of them are going to see any Social Security. So there are a lot of problems with it, even though as an academic exercise is one that has so much support in Washington. And in fact, I think we should do it, but I think we need to be aware of the problems with it. In terms of the transition, essentially there's a limited number of sources of transition funding. You can borrow money, you can raise taxes, which I don't think you can cut government spending. I think there's a lot of places we can do that, both foreignly, domestic, defense. Corporate welfare would be a good place to start. Cato's identified some $75 billion a year in subsidies we currently give to corporations. We think we could begin to use that as part of the transition. We should dedicate any general revenue surplus beyond, you know, to that rather than any spending initiatives or into any junk tax cuts that are out there. But there's no painless way to make the transition. There's also no painless way to preserve the current system. The question is, at the end of the day, have we created a better system? Or have we suffered all that pain just to keep going on and suffering more pain in the future?
Yes, I wonder, I appreciate the comments about where government spending could become, especially corporate welfare. I think that's an area that has been overlooked. Pardon me. But out in the field, I'm also a Cal graduate. I administered in a law practice to middle and lower income people, and I can see where they can really be hurt. And I think we have to think about that. We have a community ethic, a national community ethic. Perhaps we should think about some kind of national health care program that would be fine-tuned and would be able to serve the whole public and save money and not have the dilemma we're having now with the HMOs, the fiascos we're having right now. Or perhaps think about a progressive tax system.
Just throw that out to all the members.
I'm not so confident that we would do very well trying to have a national health system. I think we tried that a few years ago. And although that discussion may not have been... you're raising a point, which is that as difficult as Social Security is to solve, it's much, much easier than Medicare, or health care for that matter.
I would just add that the national health care system, whatever its merits, and I disagree with the idea, but whatever its merits doesn't solve essentially the problem that are affecting the health care system, which is essentially the miracles that health care is providing. And the fact that they cost money. And people want a lot of health care. They want it now. They want to see basically Americans want all the health care they want, whenever they want it, with the doctor they want it, as long as they don't have to pay for it. And there is no way to resolve that contradiction. And no health care system in the world has. Other national health care systems hold down costs. They do it by rationing care. They do it in essence by saying, you can't have the health care you want, and that way we'll save money. Our system says, if you can afford it, you can have all the health care you want as long as you pay for it. Now, that creates different sets of inequities in the two systems, but the inequities are still there. There is no way to have essentially an unlimited amount of something, which is what we want out of health care.
And the more you get the government, however structured, into the decision-making as to what kind of medical health, what kind of medicines and so forth you can receive, the worse it gets. Talk to some of your family or some of your friends in the UK and ask them how wonderful that health system is. You know, when the kids get sick in London, there are 12 beds for those kids. You know, what is the population of London again?
We have a book coming out this fall on American healthcare, which deals with a lot of these kinds of questions. There was a question in the back here. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to say, when it gets down to into the trenches, what happens is going to be in the year 2000 election, and this issue is going to be demagogued all over the place by the unions, the White House, and so forth, as we know. And it seems to me that the people that are making $8, $10, $12 an hour should understand that if they had something with a proprietary interest in it, they might look at it a little differently than being frightened about having to drop down into poverty. And the only way I see is if they do have individual accounts, aside from funding the money that's not there, which is different, if they can have that type of account, let's say that's the principal's guaranteed with a zero coupon or a insurance product underneath it, and the money's invested in bonds, preferred stocks, and things like that, even passbook savings. The power of compounding is what these people need, and then turn that into insurance products so they have a proprietary interest in something, and their family has some capital, because these people have nothing, except perhaps a small house. And you need something like that rather than talk about throwing money in the stock market, because you're talking about capital gains, and that's only if you got a stock you can sell to somebody. So I think playing on what's happened the last 10 years in the stock market is really risky if you're going to have a political agenda coming out and telling everybody we're going to privatize, because you can get a massive correction, you're going to be wiped out in the political sphere.
Politically, I agree with you on that. In terms of the actual economics of it, you know, while there's no guarantee of what happens in the future, it's not just the last 10 years in the stock market. We actually, making our calculations for my book, we just counted the last 5 years. We said the last 5 years of the stock market is such an anomaly that, you know, that can't be taken seriously. We just look at the historical rate for that before. For someone entering the workforce today, they'll be investing for 45 years. We said, what is the worst average rate of return over any 45-year period in U.S. history, and it was 7.5%. The worst 20-year period, including the Great Depression, was 3%. Now, we said, could we enter a position in the future where we have 45 years of less than 3%? Or, well, yes, I guess we could, but if our economy is in that bad shape, I don't know how you're going to keep going to the Social Security system either.
Okay, two more questions.
Yeah, I'd like to address Mr. Martin's concept to bother your congressman about incrementally solving the problem. You can't cross a chasm in two small jumps. As to Mr. Professor Arbour's position that the government is going to take care of the poor people at all times, that's not going to happen, and it didn't happen up until about 45 years ago. Fraternal organizations, charities, that was the purview of helping the poor, and you can't help the poor at the point of a gun. That's it.
You had a question in front here, right? The topic of so-called mutual aid societies, there were about 10,000 mutual aid societies in the United States in the 19th century, the latter half of the 19th century, and they were extremely effective and widespread, and it wasn't based on those who had versus those who did not. The most successful ones were among the most demographically impoverished and discriminated against people. So it's a good model of what people can do if they're not subject to some central plan from that bureaucracy.
My first point is just a brief addition to what Professor Auerbach meant when he said that under the administration program, the additional debt would be put into the trust fund. And that, however, does not mean the creation of net additional debt, but rather it means the shifting of debt from privately held into publicly held, which I take it is what he meant. Secondly, we have been talking about the transition problem. I mean, getting out of the mess we got into because some of things went wrong. And then we have been talking about what we want to end up with. But I wonder how the pain of the transition problem relates to what we want to end up with, Mr. Tanner. And then, Mr. Martin, when we talk about privatizing, I like to think of it this way, that there is a basic difference between saying what you do about your old age is your private business, after if there was no government. People can insure, not insure. If they don't insure, they prefer to die than they are lying in the street when they're old age. That's their business. Let them do what they want. Now, as against that, there is a question, or there is a position by which the insurance is made a social responsibility. Now, if it is made a social responsibility, it can then either be required and supervised, regulated private insurance, or it can be insurance through a public system. The point which I want to make is that the basic difference is whether you let people do what they want or whether it is a social responsibility, and not in the question whether it is privately regulated or through a public institution is quite minor compared to the first
There's a third way to interpret it, too. You could also interpret it saying there's a community responsibility or a civic duty, but that you don't believe that that duty is best fulfilled through a state enterprise. Any comments? Okay, one quick one, then we got plenty of time.
My question is about Medicare and Social Security together. The Medicare Commission is going to be reporting in a few weeks, and the stories about the Medicare Commission suggest that they're going to be creating a model that's based upon the program that federal employees have. And there's a lot of talk also in Washington about creating a system for Social Security similar to the Federal Thrift Savings Plan, which is what federal employees have for their pensions. Do you think using those models for federal employees is a good idea for both Medicare and or Social Security?
Let me address first the Medicare one. I think it's a very good start in the right direction. It will not solve Medicare's problems, and in fact, it may not be sufficient savings to offset the increase if we added prescription drug reform to Medicare. So it should be seen as a very limited reform along the way. A much better approach, I think, is one that's been suggested by Professor Tom Saving at Texas A&M University, which is to move in the direction I'm talking about for Social Security, which would in effect allow individuals to take their 2.9% Medicare tax, save that, use it at age 65 to purchase an annuity, which would then in turn pay for a life pay for a health insurance premium with a catastrophic insurance type of program. Still needs a lot of work on that. It's in the very early theoretical stages of being modeled. And I'm not sure if that's going to work. Medicare, again, I come down to it's always, I love to talk about Social Security and I hate to talk about Medicare because there are no good solutions to Medicare. In the end, the only answer to Medicare is to tell people we're not going to pay for all the things we promised them, and that's not going to fly politically, and I'm not sure about, you know, whether it's a good policy. But there is no way, I think, to keep up with the costs in the Medicare system without making major shifts. Real quick on the Federal Thrift Savings Program, it might be a good first start, but it's a limited approach. You only have three options for investment, and I think we should open it up to a much wider range of options, but it certainly is something in the right direction.
But it is appropriate to remind ourselves that the federal Medicare supplement system is so much more liberal and so serves its retirees from the federal government so much more completely that there's a question of fairness here. Is it fair that these people who've been in those lovely places on Constitution Avenue all those years and never really having to produce, you know, but always to fill out those forms and do all this other stuff that the bureaucracy does, and then to have a superior medical program when they retire, including the prescriptions, you know, whereas the ordinary citizen is stumbling around and being cheated in this way? Is that fair?
One other aspect of that is when a firm has a financial problem, they liquidate assets, they downsize, they do other kinds of things, they try to recapitalize. And I've heard very little in the discussion in Washington and elsewhere about liquidating federal assets, for example, which are huge, which is another dimension of approaching privatization is vesting assets for this liability fund. It's another thing that perhaps we could discuss at another time, but I want to thank each of our panelists very much for excellent presentations. And to all of you for joining with us. For those, again, who have not gotten either Michael's book or if you're interested in the Martin Feldstein book or others, please feel free. They're upstairs, and Michael is very happy to autograph copies of his book if you're interested. We hope that you will join with us in future Independent Institute events. Thanks for coming.
When do you fly out? Nice to meet you.